So I'm Colin. Today I'll be presenting a data compression proxy we built at Google, which we call Flywheel. So as you're probably well aware, mobile devices are rapidly becoming the dominant form of internet access. And the places where mobile devices are most popular, where they're growing fastest, are in emerging markets like India and Brazil. What's unfortunate is that the cost of mobile data is highest in precisely these places that have the highest growth potential. So to illustrate this point, here I'm showing the cost of a 500 megabyte prepaid data plan in a sampling of countries in terms of the number of hours you would need to work at the average minimum wage in that country. So the key takeaway here is that in countries such as Brazil, you would need almost a full-time minimum wage job just to be able to pay for a data plan. And so this cost is a major barrier to use of the internet in these important markets, and Google has an obvious interest in reducing this barrier. So today I'll be presenting Flywheel, which is an HTTP proxy service that automatically applies compression optimizations to web content. Flywheel has been deployed for over 3 years on a variety of platforms, and today it's currently serving millions of users and billions of requests per day. In one slide, this is what Flywheel does. We take all of the images on the page and we convert them to a format called WebP, which is extremely byte efficient. And then we pick a quality level that is appropriate for the client device. So only if the user squints at that image do they see any visual artifacts. For the rest of the page, we remove any comments and white space from any all the resources, CSS and JavaScript. And we gzip any of the objects that are not already gzipped. Now, I know some of you are probably wondering, like, isn't this a bit odd? The idea of proxying web content is almost as old as the speaker himself. And while you're right that all of the optimizations we apply are well known, the reason we wrote this paper is that the vast majority of our engineering effort went into dealing with performance artifacts and tussles that to us were unexpected. We found them counterintuitive. So the focus of this talk is on describing what these challenges were and how they informed the design of Flywheel itself. So to begin the talk, I'll briefly describe why we think a proxy is the best approach to this problem. Later, I'll describe the design and evaluation of Flywheel, and then I'll end by trying to come away with some lessons. So while it's true that many websites on the web today are well optimized for mobile devices, the fact is that most are not. So to illustrate this point, we did a measurement of all incoming HTML response bytes to Flywheel. So this is before we applied compression. And we found that 42% of all these HTML bytes were uncompressed. This is despite the fact that gzip compression is universally supported by modern web browsers. And if gzip doesn't have a chance of getting adoption from site operators, newer optimizations like the WebP image encoding format or the new HTTP2 transport protocol or whatever we happen to roll out in the next version of Chrome have very little chance of getting rapid adoption by site operators. And moreover, as mobile devices are proliferating, it becomes increasingly challenging for site operators to pick optimizations that are appropriate for the client device. So we argue that the mobile web needs some sort of optimizing service that will automatically apply optimizations that are appropriate for the client device. Just as we don't expect programmers to manually unroll loops, we shouldn't expect site operators to have to keep track of all these optimizations. So I'll now dive into the design of Flywheel itself. In designing Flywheel, we need to adhere to a few constraints. First, users should always be aware that Flywheel is turned on. They should always have to opt into the service. Similarly, we should not break web pages for users. It should be transparent to them that they turned it on. And lastly, we should only proxy HTTP content. In particular, we should not proxy HTTPS content. The key challenge that we face when we're designing Flywheel is that our goal of compression is often at odds with our goal of having low latency for end users. So as one example of where this comes up, we find that for most of our users, if they were to connect directly to the origin, the round trip times they observe would be notably smaller than if they instead proxied their content through Google. So we need to go through Google to get the compression, but then we face this trade-off that we have higher network latency. And this trade-off itself is not all that surprising. What is surprising to us is that this network latency is in fact the dominant factor that determines performance. In particular, reducing the number of bytes on the page does not actually help performance significantly. And this will be important throughout the talk. At a high level, Flywheel works pretty much like you might expect. If the user is connecting to an HTTP origin, they just send the request to the nearest Google data center. The front-end proxy checks if the response is already in cache, and if it's not, it sends it to a fetch router. The job of this fetch router is to maintain connection affinity, and what that means is it will find a fetch bot that probably has an existing connection with the origin. The fetch bot fetches the content from the origin and then starts streaming the response back. And then we pass this response through a set of optimizations. And like I said before, the optimizations we apply are image compression, gzip compression, and text minification. And we separate these services to give us better security properties and to make it easier for us to provision resources. After passing through the services, the optimizations, the response is sent to the proxy. And if the response is cacheable, the proxy sends a copy to the cache. And finally, streams the response back to the client. Now recall that we often face this trade-off between latency and compression. But luckily, we have one mechanism we can use to help navigate this trade-off. In particular, we can have clients be selective about where they send their requests. So for example, they may send small objects that are on their critical path directly to the origin, so they get low latency. But they could send larger objects that benefit greatly from data reduction through Flywheel. And we can pick this policy, this routing policy, based on our workload. The last challenge that we face in designing Flywheel involves how Flywheel affects the operation of other stakeholders on the internet. So we find that downstream middle boxes are common in transit and carrier networks. And these middle boxes are problematic for us if they tamper with our content. So for example, suppose they cache some of our transcoded images and then serve them to clients that don't actually understand our encoding format. That would break web pages for those users. By default, we handle this possibility by encrypting the connection between clients and the Flywheel servers. But for some users, encryption gets in the way of existing network policies. So for example, school networks have a need to apply parental filtering to a lot of content. And encryption gets in the way of their ability to do this. So in designing Flywheel, we need to be policy neutral, which means that Flywheel should not be a way for users to circumvent existing network policies. And the mechanism that we use to achieve neutrality is what we call HTTP fallback. So the way this works is pretty simple. We just have clients send a canary request that is well known to network operators. And if they want, they can block this request. And that will cause the clients in their network to connect to Flywheel over HTTP plain text. And this thereby allowing the network operators to achieve their policies. Okay, so having described the design of Flywheel, I'll now look into how well it works in practice. In this talk, we'll look at two of our goals. Our first goal of reducing the size of web pages for our users, as well as our second goal of maintaining good performance while we're achieving that data reduction. In the paper, we also discuss fault tolerance as well as many more details. And before we dive into compression, the compression benefits, it's useful to get a quick sense of what our traffic looks like. So here, I'm showing where our users are located in terms of adoption rates. So the second column here is the fraction of Chrome mobile users who have opted into our service. And the main takeaway from this is just that, as we had hoped, in regions where data costs are higher, we're seeing more users sign up, so we're providing some benefit to these users. Okay, it's also useful to get a sense of what kinds of web pages users are requesting. And here I'm showing a CDF of websites requested by users on the y-axis and the summation of all the bytes on that page on the x-axis in kilobytes. There are two takeaways from this graph. First, the majority of web pages requested by users are actually quite small. We find that almost 90% of all web pages are below 500 kilobytes. But if we were to sum up where all of the bytes consumed by users come from, the vast majority come from this very long tail of very large pages. So we find that 97% of all bytes come from the top 5% largest pages. And this distinction will become important later on. Okay, so here I'm showing the benefits of data reduction through Flywheel. And this is from the perspective of the server. And this second column here, savings, is computed as the inverse proportion of outgoing bytes to incoming bytes. So here, higher is better. And on the top row, we just see that on average, Flywheel provides about 58% data reduction. And the bottom of this table just breaks down where this data savings comes from in terms of resource type. And the main takeaway there is just that images are the lion's share of both incoming bytes to Flywheel, as well as where we get most of our data reduction benefits. We also took a look at how compression is perceived by end users themselves. So here's a CDF of users on the y-axis, and then again our compression ratio on the x-axis. So further to the right is better. And we find that in the median case, Flywheel provides about 50% data reduction. But recall that not all traffic is going through Flywheel. So for example, HTTPS traffic is going directly to the origin. So if we sum across all bytes consumed by users, we see that Flywheel provides about 27% reduction. Okay, so in evaluating performance, recall that our goal is not to significantly degrade performance while we're providing these data reduction benefits. And we evaluate this goal by comparing a random sampling of Flywheel users to a holdback experimental group. And this is another random sampling of users who have opted into the Flywheel service, but temporarily have their requests sent directly to the origin. And this is crucial for avoiding sampling bias. We should not be comparing to non-Flywheel users. Okay, so before I look at the results, it's useful to build a quick intuition for what determines page load time. This is the metric that we're most interested in. So a web page just consists of multiple objects, as I'm showing with these white boxes here. And the load time for each of these objects is determined by three factors: the propagation delay through the network, the transmission delay, as well as the computation time on the client itself. Now, we can define the critical path of the web page as the longest chain of dependent resources. And then the page load time itself can be defined as the summation of the load times for each of those objects on the critical path. And here we see the results. In blue, we have Flywheel users, and in yellow, we have the holdback experimental group. And here, lower is better. And if you look at the median case on the far left, we see that Flywheel's impact on performance is more or less a wash. It's only until you get to the tail of this distribution, and note that these quantiles are not evenly spaced, that we start to see that Flywheel provides any benefit for performance, it's any reduction in page load time. Okay, so on the one hand, this is a great result. We're providing great data reduction without negatively impacting performance. But on the other hand, this is really weird, right? We're chopping off a third of all bytes, and yet we aren't seeing much of a reduction in page load time. So why is that? So to understand, we need to recall some properties of our workload. We have a long tail of extremely large pages. And for very large pages, transmission delay, or the time it takes to get the bytes down through the pipe, is the dominant factor in determining performance. And so that's why at the tail of that distribution earlier, we started seeing reduction in page load time. But most of the pages requested by users are quite small. And for small pages, propagation delay, or this is basically the length of the path between users and Google and then to the origin and then back again, is the dominant factor in determining performance. Okay? And the way that we'll understand propagation delay is by looking at another metric called time to first byte. Again, this is basically measuring the network path through Google and then to the origin and back again. And here we see that across the board for almost all of these quantiles, the time to first byte is greater than it is through if users were to instead go directly to the origin. And what this means is that proximity is crucial for determining network latency. Often, users are closer to the origin than they are if they were to instead proxy their content through Google. Okay, so I'll end this talk by trying to synthesize some lessons that might be useful for other system designers. And our first lesson was also the most frustrating. We found that many of the optimizations we expected to have good impact on performance did not actually provide significant results when we deployed them at web scale. So as one example, we looked at an optimization called Preconnect. And as an illustrating example here, suppose that we're streaming an HTML response from foo.com. And as we're streaming this response, we parse the HTML and see that there's another sub-resource. And that sub-resource is owned by a different origin, bar.com. And here what we do is we speculatively open up a TCP connection with bar.com. And now, later, when the user requests that object, the DNS resolution and the TCP handshake are off of the critical path. We find that this optimization does increase the fraction of reused connections somewhat, from 73% to 80%. But if you look at page load time, which is the metric we really care about, we see a negligible decrease in the median case, only less than 2% decrease in page load time. So we decided to take this optimization out of production because it incurs high overheads for origins as well as Google. And the reason that this optimization does not provide a significant result is just that there are so many users in the system already that there's already a strong tendency for connection affinity. 73% of these connections are already over a hot TCP connection. We also looked at a related optimization known as prefetch. And the setup here is basically the same as before. Suppose we're streaming HTML back from foo.com. And we see the sub-resource, and we actually go ahead and fetch the entire object itself. And if that object is cacheable, then we can serve it out of our cache rather than having to go to the origin at all. And this, we found this did actually provide some benefit. It increases cache hit ratio from 22% to 33%. But again, if you look at page load time, it has less than 2% decrease in the median case. And the reason for this is just that cacheable items are often not on the critical path. It's very hard to get these cacheable items to actually affect end-to-end page load time. So in sum, improving page load time is highly challenging because reducing bytes doesn't help much, and it's also very difficult to actually target the critical path. Okay, the last lesson we learned was just that if you want to get widespread adoption, it's crucial for you to consider policy issues in your design. As system designers, we have a tendency to want to apply the encryption hammer to the middle box nail. But it turns out that having an adversarial relationship with network operators was not a practical approach for us. We needed our design to be flexible with respect to network policies. So there are many more results in the paper, which I don't have time to go over. And I'll just conclude by saying that we show in this work that it's possible to provide 58% data reduction at web scale. And the main theme from our work is just that data reduction, in retrospect, is actually the easy part. Dealing with performance artifacts and real-world tussles consume by far the largest part of our effort. And feel free to send me an email after the session or also talk to Matt, who's down there in the audience. Thanks a lot.
Hey, Raghav Sethi from Princeton. I was wondering, your canary mechanism requires operators to block access to a URL. Did you consider doing something like making a parallel request for that URL and not serving the page if it didn't go through? Or was there a reason that that wouldn't be an approach that was easier?
So this design option just turned out to be the simplest thing that worked well for existing network operators. I'm not sure, maybe you can ask Matt later if we considered other options. I don't think so.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, Kostin Reicher from Polytechnic Hubcast. So really, really cool work. One thing I was wondering, so you mentioned this policy issue, and there's a concerted effort by Google and others to actually go, you know, fully encrypted transport, you know, quick, you name it. So what do you make of this? I mean, how will it turn out? You
know? Right. That's a good question. So I should mention that, you know, when I was at Google, I worked on technical problems. I did not, in particular, work on policy issues. So I can't really speak to Google's stance on this issue. But I will say that there's nothing technically stopping us from proxying HTTPS traffic. I mean, you might just think of, conceptually, you might just think of Flywheel as an extension of your Chrome process that lives in the cloud. We didn't do that for product reasons, but again, I wasn't involved in that decision.
Hi, Wei Chu from Purdue. I was wondering, for those results, did you distinguish the result from the connection through the mobile connection and the Wi-Fi connection? Are there different results?
If you look at Wi-Fi versus mobile?
Yes.
We didn't do that breakdown in the paper. As far as I understand, so the main result from our work, from our evaluation in the paper is that network latency is the biggest cost, the biggest performance cost. So I don't imagine that there's going to be a significant difference in just the first hop. It's really their proximity to the data center that's the main factor that's determining the performance. Yeah. Hey.
Hey, Amit from Stanford. Really nice talk, Colin. Thanks. So you said, I think you had mentioned that the fact that round-trip times through Flywheel were longer than directly to the HTTP origin was unintuitive, or at least it's unintuitive to me.
Right.
Because we would expect most things to be cached, and we would expect Google servers to be closer to edge locations than HTTP origin servers. So do you have a sense for why?
Well, recall that a lot of our users are in emerging markets like Brazil or India, and our footprint is just not as big there. I'm not sure what else to say.
So if I can follow up, do you expect the results that you had to be significantly different if Google just had more, Flywheel just had more presence in the edge locations?
Okay. Yes, that's right. So we isolated that the time to first byte is a crucial factor in determining page load time, and if you were closer, that would be lower. So absolutely.
Thanks.
Yeah.